Thanks, Lawrence. Thanks, Kangan News. It really is great to be here in person and see so many of you here, also in 3D. That makes for a nice change. Last year at this event, which was one of those two-dimensional ones, I discussed the bank's term funding facility. Today, I'm going to focus on the bank's bond purchase program. At its meeting earlier this month, as well as raising the cash rate target, the board decided not to reinvest the proceeds from bonds as they mature from the bank's portfolio. So this signals the next phase in the bond purchase program. The initial phase, of course, in which the bank built up its stock of bond holdings is often referred to as quantitative easing, or QE for short. That phase ended in February this year. We've now entered the phase known as quantitative tightening, or QT. By allowing our bond holdings to gradually diminish over time, as they mature, the initial stimulatory effects of those holdings, so namely the downward pressure on government bond yields and the Australian dollar, those effects will gradually unwind. In my presentation today, I'm going to be explaining the reasoning behind the decision to begin QT. I'll then discuss some of the implications of QT for financial conditions and explore what it means for the bank's balance sheet and the operation of monetary policy through the cash rate. But first, I'll briefly recap the QE phase of the program. The bank introduced the bond purchase program back in November 2020 to provide additional support to the Australian economy in the early and still very uncertain stage of its economic recovery from the COVID shock. This was a new element to the package of policy measures adopted right at the outset of the pandemic. The very low level of the cash rate target was already anchoring the front end of the yield curve. The bank's forward commitment on the cash rate and the three-year bond yield target were tying down the yield curve a few years out. And in this context, the bond purchase program was designed to further ease financial conditions by lowering bond yields further out the curve and contributing to downward pressure on the exchange rate. The program was introduced at a time when the unemployment rate was close to 7% and it was expected to rise even further. Inflation was low at only 1.25% in underlying terms, and it was widely anticipated to rise only gradually. Indeed, most of the market economists that we regularly survey at that time were forecasting that underlying inflation would remain well below 2%, at least until the end of 2022. In addition, the central banks of other major advanced economies, they had been purchasing significant amounts of government bonds for some time under pandemic-related asset purchase programs, as you can see here in this chart. While those programs had led to an easing in financial conditions in global financial markets, they'd also contributed to upward pressure on the Australian dollar. By October 2020, these central banks were holding close to 30% or more of their government's bonds on issue. And by contrast, the Reserve Bank held only around 9% of Australian government securities outstanding. And that followed purchases to restore market function in the early months of the pandemic and as well in support of the bank's three-year yield target. Financial market participants anticipated a substantial amount of purchases under the program of both AGS and bonds issued by state and territory governments, the SEMIs, of that 5 to 10 year maturity buckets that we were purchasing from. Under the bond purchase program, the bank has acquired almost $224 billion of AGS and $57 billion of SEMIs. These were purchased in the secondary market between November 2020 and February 2022, when the board decided to cease purchases. By then, the bank's share of AGS outstanding had risen to around 35%, which was above the equivalent share for the US Fed, but still below other central banks like the RBNZ and the Bank of Canada. The share of our holdings relative to GDP had been consistently lower than other advanced economy central banks, reflecting the relatively low level of Australian public debt as a share of GDP. And you can see that in the right-hand panel of this chart. Our estimates suggest that the bond purchase program reduced longer-term AGS yields by around 30 basis points. and in addition, it lowered the spread of yields on semis to AGS by between 5 and 10 basis points. Not surprisingly, given the forward-looking nature of bond markets, most of these effects appear to have been associated with announcements that related to the purchases and the subsequent expectations that market participants formed about the stock of bonds that the bank would ultimately hold, rather than the actual purchases taking place. And that was broadly in line with what was experienced internationally. The decline in bond yields helped to lower financing costs for borrowers, contributed to a lower exchange rate than otherwise would have been the case, and supported asset prices and balance sheets of businesses and households. So now I want to turn to QT. But the precursor to QT was that decision back in February 2022 to end QE by ceasing purchases under the bond purchase program. That decision was made on the basis of three criteria. First, by the time of the February meeting, most other central banks had concluded their pandemic purchase programs or were flagging that they would do so shortly. Second, while the Australian bond market had been functioning reasonably well, some pressure points had begun to emerge, and these were related to the high share of some bond lines that were held by the bank, though they were being mitigated in part by our stock lending activities shown here, which have been focused largely on bonds in the three-year futures basket. Third, and most importantly, there was a significant progress towards our goals, with the unemployment rate declining at that time to 4.2% and inflation rising in underlying terms to be close to the centre of the 2 to 3% target range for the first time in 7 years. So by the time of the May board meeting, the economy was looking stronger still, and stronger than had been forecast just 3 months prior. Unemployment had declined to a very low level, one which has not been seen for a very long time. Inflation in the March quarter was high. It was also higher than had been expected. In part, that was due to the effects of the invasion of Ukraine on commodity prices, particularly oil prices. But high inflation had also become more broadly based, with underlying inflation rising to 3.7% and pressures building in a number of non-tradable categories. There was also evidence from the bank's own liaison program, as well as business surveys, that there had been a further lift in the growth of labour costs in March and April. Now, the ABS released the wage price index for the March quarter last week, but it was based on information that they obtained in mid-February. And that subsequently, after the board meeting, had showed a further pickup in the year-ended rate of growth of wages, with pockets of stronger wages growth in parts of the economy. But given what was the information to hand and the background I've described, the board's assessment in May was that it was time to begin raising interest rates and start the process of QT. The decline in our bond holdings will be gradual over this year and next. The first major maturities from the bond portfolio will be about $2 billion worth of the July 2022 Australian Government bond, followed by $2 billion of the November 2022 bond. The maturity of the April 2023 bond is much larger at slightly over $13 billion. Maturities, as you can see here, will then step up again to be more sizeable from 2024. The average maturity of the bank's holdings is a little lower than for most other advanced economies, as you can see here. This largely reflects the fact that the bank didn't buy bonds beyond those in the 10-year futures basket, and that's in contrast to other central banks like the Bank of England, the US Fed, and the Bank of Canada that purchased bonds at maturities of beyond 20 years. Also in contrast to the Reserve Bank, those central banks have bonds maturing in the near term, actually, and they had been purchased as part of earlier asset purchase programs well prior to the pandemic. Now, some central banks have decided to sell bonds in order to run down their portfolio faster than otherwise, or at least have indicated that they'll consider that option. However, the Reserve Bank Board noted that it currently has no plans to sell bonds from its portfolio. That decision reflected a number of considerations. First, the board judged that raising the cash rate was the best way of reducing the extent of monetary stimulus in the economy. In particular, it's easier to adjust policy and influence financial conditions by calibrating just one instrument rather than two in response to evolving conditions. Second, sales of bonds by the bank into the market could potentially complicate the task of issuance by the federal, state, and territory authorities, including by adding to volatility in bond markets. And third, should a bond buying program be needed in the future to support the economy, then it would be likely to be more effective if sales are avoided this time around. And that's because setting a precedent of sales in the phase of the current program could reduce the effectiveness of a given value of any future bond purchases. And that's because the effect of those purchases on bond yields and the exchange rate would arguably be lessened if the market were to anticipate a fast rundown of holdings next time around. In short, the market would probably assume that once a seller, always a seller. Anyway, now that the process of QT has started, the path of the bank's bond holdings is clear. So long as markets are sufficiently forward-looking, this means that yields today should reflect all of the information available about the steady decline in the bank's holdings. The effect that our purchase program has had on bond yields and the exchange rate, that will persist while we hold those bonds, but it will gradually diminish over time. In particular, the effect of the extra demand in the market associated with the bank's purchase of bonds gradually falls as those bonds move towards and then eventually reach maturity in a very predictable way. Of course, many other forces, including global developments, will be affecting bond yields at the same time. But the key point I want to make is that as the bank's holdings gradually mature, their contribution to lower bond yields will slowly diminish. And while that reduction in stimulus is appropriate given the economic circumstances, as I mentioned already, reducing the very substantial monetary policy stimulus put in place at the outset of the pandemic will be a task best served by increases in the cash rate. So now I want to turn to the balance sheet and the operation of monetary policy. The bank's bond portfolio will remain substantial for some years to come, and so too will the bank's balance sheet. By April 2024, about $47 billion worth of bonds purchased in support of the yield target and market functioning will have matured. And as you can see here, the last of the $188 billion provided to banks under the Term Funding Facility, that's due at the end of June 2024. Despite these substantial declines up to that point, the bank's balance sheet will still be at least twice as large as it was, as what it was just prior to the pandemic. It'll decline gradually thereafter with bond maturities, as you can see here, of between $35-45 billion every year time. Now, one of the consequences of the bank's bond purchase program and other policy measures adopted in response to the pandemic is the abundance of exchange settlement balances. So these are held by commercial banks and other financial institutions at the Reserve Bank, and they're used to settle transactions between banks. Banks can also lend them to others in the overnight cash market, with those transactions determining the cash rate. As expected, the abundance of ES balances led to a noticeable decline in the demand to trade cash overnight. It's also been unsurprising that the cash rate has traded slightly below the cash rate target, as you can see here, since about late March 2020. While ES balances will decline as the various monetary policy measures adopted during the pandemic unwind, as discussed, that process is going to take a number of years. Recently, the board considered options to actually reduce ES balances more quickly. If it were to do that, banks would have more of an incentive to borrow funds overnight, since their ES balances would once more become relatively scarce. Hence, such a change would encourage more trading in the overnight cash market, with the cash rate trading closer to and eventually around the cash rate target. However, the benefits of reducing ES balances quickly were judged to be modest compared with the risks, including the potential to create volatility in a range of financial markets. Moreover, While the abundance of ES balances affects the behaviour of the cash rate relative to the cash rate target, it doesn't impair the ability of the bank to achieve the desired stance of monetary policy via adjustments in the cash rate target and the rate paid on ES balances. In particular, because ES balances will remain abundant for some time, the cash rate will tend to be priced as a margin above the ES balance rate. And that's because the ES balance rate is really the opportunity cost for banks considering whether or not to lend spare cash overnight or leave it sitting with the Reserve Bank. But given that that gap between the ES balance rate and the cash rate target is just 10 basis points, this also means that the cash rate is only trading a little below the cash rate target. Moreover, banks borrowing cash have little need to pay more than the cash rate target. They know there should be many banks willing to lend cash at that price. And if needed, they can obtain similar liquidity themselves via the Reserve Bank's open market operations at a similar term matched rate. When considering the framework, the board saw value in continuing to set and communicate both the remuneration rate on ES balances and the cash rate target in its policy announcements. It also agreed to maintain that current margin of 10 basis points between that ES rate and the cash rate target, subject to periodic review, as the margin could change over time as market conditions evolve. In the current environment, though, that modest difference helps to ensure effective control of the cash rate. So let me just draw a few conclusions together. In May, the board began the process of removing some of the extraordinary monetary policy stimulus that it put in place to help support the economy through the pandemic. The focus of most observers at that time was on the 25 basis point increase in the cash rate target and the rate paid on ES balances. That's as it should be. But at the same time, the bank also decided to proceed with quantitative tightening by allowing its bond holdings to mature in a steady and predictable way over time. The bond purchase program was adopted in late 2020 to provide additional support to the Australian economy at a time when the cash rate was reduced to its effective lower bound. The bond purchase has helped to reduce yields further out the curve, contributed also to a lower value of the Australian dollar than otherwise would have been the case. As the bank now takes steps to remove the considerable monetary stimulus, increases in the cash rate are the tried and tested measure that will do most of the work, including because they can be easily calibrated to evolving economic conditions. The end of the TFF and the gradual process of QT, they'll also play a role in this task, but a predictable and a modest one. Because the bond portfolio will mature gradually, the bank's balance sheet and commercial bank's ES balances, they're going to remain large for some years. This means that the cash rate will continue to trade slightly below the cash rate target, but above the rate paid on ES balances. Most importantly, though, the bank will continue to be able to maintain effective control over the cash rate as it withdraws monetary policy stimulus in the period ahead. Thank you very much. I'm in Lawrence's hands and look forward to your questions.
Thanks very much, Chris. There are some questions that have come through. Just a reminder, you can ask questions through the conference app. If you go into the agenda in the current session, there's Q&A in there. So some people have obviously worked that out. If not, put your hand up. We'll get you a microphone. I'll look around the room. But in the meantime, I'll ask the first question that has come in. Chris, what do you think is the neutral cash rate and how quickly might we get with that?
Well, the first point I'd make on the neutral cash rate, it's very uncertain. It changes over time. It depends very much on potential growth, people's willingness to take risks. Model estimates would have it somewhere between 2 and 3 at the moment, but that's very rough, and maybe even those bands are too narrow. I think the neutral rate's something that you know when you get closer to it.
Okay, thanks very much. Next question is about wages growth. Obviously, wages growth so far still undershooting. How important is wage growth as an input to interest rate settings?
Oh, look, I think it is important. It's certainly not the only thing. The board's going to be looking for evidence on inflation and the labour market, and wages growth is important on both scores. Of course, the recorded wage growth by the ABS isn't sufficiently high for inflation to be durably in that 2-3% range. We have seen it rise. We are seeing other evidence of wage pressures picking up, and we're pretty confident that they'll pick up to an extent that will make inflation consistent with that 2-3% band.
Okay, thanks very much. Next one, the US market is increasingly leaning towards pricing in a recession locally. What are the RBA's policy options if the economy here goes into a downturn or recession?
Well, it's very hypothetical, but with that caveat in mind, I mean, I think the thing people often get focused on, because it's the much more exciting thing and easier to grasp, certainly in the press, is to focus on changes in policy. But remember, policy is very stimulatory at the moment. It's the level of rates that matters. So if more stimulus is needed, we're already delivering that stimulus right now. I often hear us being referred to as putting our foot on the brake when we raise rates. That's not the right analogy. At the moment, we're just easing off the accelerator. There's more of that to come. But policy is very stimulatory, including these bonds, as you saw, are going to be sitting there on our books for quite some time. So that's providing stimulus as well.
A couple of related questions. Speaking of the bonds on the book, is any consideration being given to selling down holdings specifically as an anti-inflationary measure?
No, largely for the reasons I explained. For a number of reasons, as I suggested, we don't think it'll be particularly helpful to sell them. It could reduce the stimulus a little bit, but it would only be modest. I think you can achieve what you need to through a sufficient tightening in the cash rate if needed. As I said, it would complicate the task of the issuance authorities. Remember, we've got a pretty large amount of our balance sheet rolling off in the next couple of years through the TFF.
Okay, now the next one that was related is going back to hypotheticals, I guess, but is the RBA concerned about stagflation?
Well, I know that's a concern globally. I don't think that's an issue that is pressing for us right now. Remember, we've got an Australian labour market that looks strong. We've got pretty strong momentum in economic activity. We're opening the borders. We've got very high savings still for households and many businesses. There's a pipeline of construction work to be done, both private and public, and there's quite a lot of ongoing policy support. And remember, wages growth is strengthening, but from pretty low levels. And unlike the rest of the world, we've got the benefit of higher commodity prices. As tragic as that, the cause of that is, we are benefiting from those commodity prices.
Okay, thanks very much. Some more questions coming in. That's excellent. What will the RBA do with the cash received from upcoming maturities?
Well, we have an asset and we have a liability. And so once the bond matures, that asset goes, and then the liability gets withdrawn as well. There's less ES balances in banks' accounts. That comes about because the government has to fund the maturity of those bonds. So the cash comes from somewhere, it comes out of ES balance accounts.
Okay, moving on, a technical question here. As you hike rates and pay commensurately higher interest costs on ES balances, how comfortable are you with the RBA's capital position? Are you at risk of requiring a recapitalisation?
Well, we've said a bit about that in our annual report. We'll say more about that this year. You can imagine that we're made some losses on the bond portfolio associated with the sharp rise in yields. But I can't say much more than that at this stage.
Sure, okay. Just going through these chronologically as they come in, they're coming in thick and fast now, so I'll try and get through as many as possible. A question about, do you have any concern about a hard landing, given that companies and consumers made plans around the guidance that the RBA gave in late 2021 that rates wouldn't increase until 2024?
No. I mean, we'll be watching the capacity of households to repay loans and how that's going and how it might affect consumption. But remember, a lot of households and mortgage holders got ahead of things during the pandemic. Not everyone, of course, but savings of households went up very significantly. They're still sitting on those. Those who had mortgages got ahead of their mortgages. The other thing, of course, is when banks and other lenders decide on how much to lend to somebody, they test them about their capacity to be able to repay at higher rates. And that that threshold has been increased recently by APRA. So households should be able to manage that. And indeed, remember, the idea of higher rates is to actually reduce people's consumption capacity, not to turn consumption around, but just to slow its growth at the margin, as well as investment. That's how you make sure you keep a lid on inflation.
Okay, there's an inflation question here, actually, next in the list. Does the RBA believe raising the cash rate will counteract rising inflation effectively, given that inflation is arguably more supply-driven than demand-driven?
It's a good question. I mean, I think there's a lot of uncertainties, and we've been the first to emphasise these. But the two big pictures we've seen are the supply-side pressures, and yes, there isn't much a central bank can do about those. Their effect on inflation should wane over time. We don't, in order for them to continue to push inflation higher, you need those supply pressures to ratchet on and ever upwards. So as long as that doesn't happen, as long as they stabilise or even reverse a little bit, that should keep inflation from rising and may even help inflation fall. On the other side, we had low wages. We were looking for nominal wage growth to pick up. That's in process. So the board will be watching how those two forces play out.
I might ask one myself, Chris, with apologies to the people who are waiting in the queue. Where are you in terms of the forecasts and expectations you had about the supply chain costs? I mean, we've talked for what seems like the best part of a year now about how we expect those to ease, but, you know, would you have thought it would be happening by now? When do you think it should start to happen?
Well, this isn't my area of expertise anymore, but my sense of some of the numbers I'd been seeing is there were signs that those supply side pressures were coming off. Shipping costs, for example, is a good example of that. The thing we have to be very watchful, though, is what's happening in China right now. But remember, that's kind of a demand and supply shock all at once. So that's a big unknown. And as tragic as the war in Ukraine is, and as long as that's likely to persist, again, I come back to the point, as long as the pressures from those supply side shocks don't ratchet higher, that shouldn't add to inflation. As long as they stabilise, that will not be adding to inflation. If they even ease a bit, they'll bring inflation back a bit.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. We'll try and get through two or three more. You're probably expecting this one. Does the outcome of the election impact the RBA's forecasts?
No. There you go.
Maybe we'll get through four. Okay, another question about the change in guidance. The governor spoke about a review into forward guidance as a monetary policy tool earlier this month. How concerned is the RBA about reneging on forward guidance and that denting confidence in the Reserve Bank?
Well, I think obviously it's not good to for credibility to have to do that, but equally, so it's not good for our credibility to not be responsive and flexible to changing circumstances. So that's the most important thing to focus on. But look, we're conducting some internal reviews ourselves. At the moment, I'm overseeing one on the yield target. We'll be presenting that to the board, and then in due course, we'll make that public. And then we'll roll through some of the other policies. But remember, some of them still have some way to play out, including things like the term funding facility. So some of them might take a while.
Okay, another technical one here. We'll try and get two more in. In November 2019, pre-QE, the RBA presented a chart referencing ACGB to OIS basis. Is the RBA concerned with the current deeply negative sovereign to OIS basis, particularly in the three-year basket?
No, I mean, I think some of that's come about through our yield target policies, but no, not particularly concerned. I think the market's functioning well enough, and as I suggested, our program of lending bonds into the market, if that helps, is helping to defray some of those pressures.
Okay, maybe one more, another technical one. Why do you put so much faith in the stock effect versus the flow effect, re-QE?
Well, that's just what the evidence seems to show. That's what you would think theory would tell you about the effect on the level of yields. I think the flow is important when it comes to things like bond market functioning. That's what we were doing very early on in the pandemic with our bond purchases. But in terms of things like the yield target, but more in particular the bond purchase program, it really does, the evidence does suggest the stock matters. I think there's a footnote in my full speech available online talking about a paper that's coming out soon, and I believe it's as soon as tomorrow, which will provide quite comprehensive econometric analysis for those who want to go through all that technical detail.
Can't wait. Please join me.
It's a good paper.
Thanks very much. Please join me in thanking Christopher Kent. Thank you.